everybody, and welcome back to Book Hype. This is episode number 134, where we're going to be talking about the good, the bad, and the ugly of the book world, and catch you up on the latest book news. Today, I'm joined by Karen and Kristen. How are you ladies doing?
Pretty good.
All right. We were rocking out to some Oliver and Company before jumping into some book news. So
yes, we were.
If you remember Oliver and Company and enjoy it, please let us know so we don't feel so alone in the world. So let's kick it off with what we've been reading. And I will start just because I have just been continuing what I've been listening to / reading from last week. And that is The Wanderers. I've been listening to that on my way to and from work when I don't have any new podcasts, and it still remains to be fantastic. I finished Northanger Abbey again, and I've been skimming through the Trainspotting scripts when I still can't fall asleep, so that's been fun. I've also been flipping through Irvin Welsh's book Porno, which is loosely the premise for T2 Trainspotting. So I'm still in that funk, guys. I'll get out of it eventually, but I'm still very deep into the Trainspotting funk. So I keep going back and forth between the screenplay and the book and reading Simon and Renton sections. So I'm hoping to emerge from this hole soon. Once the movie gets out of theaters and I lose the ability to keep seeing it, then I'll move on. But Kristen, please tell us all about Roar, because I know you are dying to talk about it.
Basically, for the next like 2 months until it comes out, I'm going to convince everyone in the world to read Roar. I was like pretty excited about this book before I read it, and now that I've read it, I love it even more. First of all, I'm so glad that this book came out of Cora finally. Like, she talks about how like this idea and this story has been cooking for so long, and like she's always kind of dreamed about writing a fantasy series and never really thought she'd ever get the chance. Like, she writes contemporary romance really well, and she just never thought she'd have an opportunity. And knowing that this story like exists in her brain just makes me love her even more. It's great, guys. I have to say that I, at one point during the story, thought I knew what was coming next, because I know, you know, like, I've read enough fantasy and dystopian novels to like be able to predict events, and I totally saw what was coming, and then it never happened, and this other thing happened, and then ta-da, the book was done, and I'm like, wait, no, this can't be it. No, wait, stop. Let's go back. So I will definitely be rereading this before it is released in June, and I have so many questions and so much to talk about. You will be sick of hearing about Roar. Just read it, make me happy. But it's so, so, so good, and I can't wait for the rest of the world to get a chance at it, because I'm so excited.
Your excitement makes me excited for a book I didn't think I'd ever be excited about. So
it's just different. It's so different. And ugh, I'm just so happy. Okay. Moving on.
Karen, still trucking along, still a little busy. We'll get there.
If only you guys knew.
We'll get you out of your non-reading funk. Yeah. It will happen.
I mean, I have to within the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, you
No more excuses.
There are officially no more excuses, Book Hype listeners, because we have set an official date for the Jane Austen episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Coming at you 6 months late.
Okay. I'm so sorry.
It's actually closer to 5, so let's not push it.
Wow. December just got real rough real fast, yeah, and we never recovered, but we're getting there.
I'm going to announce it right now that April 29th, that weekend, we are coming together to talk about Jane Austen. I'm going to wear a full 19th century garb, and I'm going to drink tea, and it's going to be wonderful, because I feel like I've been preparing my whole life for this.
I'm going to do my absolute best to make it worth that 5-month wait.
We're going to do it. It's going to be great. I'm looking forward to it immensely. Yeah. So try to come up with some fun stuff for you guys and send us some suggestions. Like, what's your favorite Jane Austen book? We really want to make it a great episode because I feel like we've been talking about it forever and I don't want it to be a disappointment. So yeah, send us some ideas or just things that you like, your favorite adaptations or quotes, anything you want about Jane Austen or want us to talk about with Jane Austen, let us know because we're building our agenda for that. All right, let's move on to our book bites for this week. So when this episode comes out, it will be right around National Siblings Day, which is April 10th. And I wanted to know what everyone's favorite sibling relationship is in literature, just one that you've read that has stuck with you, that you just love, and or if it relates to, you know, your own relationships with siblings, if you have any. And let's kick it off with Karen. What are some of your favorite sibling relationships?
Well, I am an only child, so unfortunately, I do not have the experience of having a sibling. Although I did grow up with my cousins, and they were awful, so I expect that having a sibling is very similar to that. And also, my best friend and I are very, very close, so I imagine, but she's awesome. So I imagine maybe that's the flip side of things. But I do really like reading about sibling relationships because I think that dynamic is very unique. It's one thing to, you know, find a best friend or find a significant other. It's another to have a sibling, somebody that you kind of can't get away from, and what that relationship is like. Because sometimes they can be very contentious and hateful, and sometimes it can be closer than any other relationship you'll have in your entire life. So it's really interesting to me. But the first ones that came to mind are Fred and George Weasley, because how can you not talk about them when you're talking about National Sibling Day? And I really like them because they're jokesters. They're always there for each other. They're always kind of in the other person's brain, or they share a brain is probably the more accurate way to put it. And their relationship was interesting to me because they never seemed to fight. They never seemed to not be on the same page. Being twins made them so incredibly close. And the fact that they were always there for each other was really awesome, because a lot of twins in books, you know, they don't like being similar and they try to reject that. They try to be individual. And Fred and George were never worried about that. They used that to their advantage to get up to shenanigans. And I just always thought, like, to be that close was something to strive for. My other favorite one is Merlin and Rhiannon from T.A. Barron's Merlin series. This one is pretty cool because they discover that they're siblings. I think it's later on in the books. It's been a really long time since I've read them, but you're not aware right away that they actually are brother and sister. And they have a very loving, very supportive system between the two of them, despite the fact that they didn't grow up together. And I really love Rhiannon because she is this very nurturing person who is very in touch with nature. And she balances out Merlin in a lot of ways. And just the way that they kind of are there for each other, no questions, and not afraid to tell the other person when they do something wrong, but never in a hateful way, is something that I really enjoyed. And then Lucy and Edmund from the Chronicles of Narnia have to be another favorite sibling relationship because they kind of were awful to each other. Well, I take that back. Edmund was awful to Lucy when they were younger, and he was the one that, you know, didn't believe that Narnia existed, and he kind of went out of his way to make her seem like she was crazy. But I mean, Edmund is my favorite character from that series, and his arc throughout the Chronicles is something that I really appreciate. But in part, that's also his relationship with Lucy, because they leave Narnia far later than Peter and Susan do. And through that, they really bond. And I think it's cool to see Lucy grow up and become more mature and confident whereas Edmund's maturity comes with just kind of being a better, more caring and empathetic person. And the fact that they can kind of do that together and really support each other and understand why Narnia and Aslan mean so much to them is really cool. And I always enjoy seeing how that goes through the first movie and through the books in general.
Awesome. Kristen, what about you?
Okay, so Karen stole Fred and George, which I think is everyone's favorite twin pair, you know, in existence. How can they not be? But a couple of my faves. I love the Ferris brothers and, in extension, the entire Stage Dive crew. All of those boys basically feel like brothers by the time you read all of their stories. For those that don't know, I'm talking about the Stage Dive books by Kylie Scott. And Jimmy and, wow, I just totally blanked on David's name. Wow, I'm having a day. Jimmy and David are just, their relationship is really contentious at the beginning of the series, and they're not close. You kind of have an idea of what they went through as kids, and you don't really get it until you get more of Jimmy's story in the third book. And once you finally see what he went through, you figure out like why he's so standoffish and why Dave, you know, has a better, you know, grip on reality and has a better coping mechanism than Jimmy ever had. And yeah, it's really their relationship, especially at the end of Lead, really grows and is really beautiful. And I can't wait to run into them, hopefully, in Kylie's new series, the Dive Bar series. She's got, it's set in their hometown, not where the Stage Dive books are set, but like where they're actually from. And it's completely unrelated to them, except that they definitely go visit occasionally. And they've showed up in the first book in Dirty just very minutely. And I'm hoping we'll get a Jimmy sighting pretty soon because he's my favorite.
James and David are from Once Upon a Time. And aww. I was like, that's kind of interesting. And then as I was Googling that to make sure that those were their names, James and David Franco. It's like there's a lot of James and David siblings.
Yeah, that's weird. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah.
They're just Jimmy and Dave. I don't think anything of it. That's hilarious. Oh, boys. Okay. And my other favorites, of course, are the Archer brothers from Jay Crownover's Marked Men. It's all about Rule and Rome and Remy, but we don't really get to see much of Remy. Rome is my favorite book in that series. Anyone who's read it knows why. He's just this soldier and he's good and he is having such a hard time in his life. And everything that happens in that book is just like kismet. Like he is in the right place at the right time and the right things happen and it brings him out of his funk. And I love that book so much. But if you have not read The Marked Men, the first book is Rule, and it's all about this insane character. Rule is nuts. He's combative. He's tough to get along with. He's just basically a pain in the ass, but once you get to know him and get him on your side, like he's the most loyal and the most protective and the most incredible friend you could ever have. And I love those books so much. They were at the beginning of my romance adventure. Like I definitely discovered The Marked Men very, very quickly and just absolutely fell in love with them. And they have an interesting story as brothers. Remy, who I mentioned before, is actually Rule's twin, who at the beginning of the series we find out has died. And so that affects the other brothers in a way that you wouldn't necessarily see coming. It has made them closer, but at the same time has pulled them apart. And as the Marked Men tale is told, you find out everything that's happened in the Archer family, and it just explodes at one point. So I love that family and those books, and they will always have a special place in my heart.
I've read half that series, and I can confirm that Kristen is telling the truth.
Yeah. So good. So good.
I'll have to check that out. That sounds really great. So my favorite sibling pairings. The first one I'll talk about, I can't really talk about until April 29th. So it's Jane and Elizabeth Bennett. I love their relationship, but I'll hold on to why I love it until Karen finally reads Pride and Prejudice. But just a little teaser, it's great. And I think that the Bennett sister dynamic is also just fantastic. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like a timeless tale of sisters growing up together. So stay tuned for more on that.
I love them in Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, so I totally understand where you're coming from.
Okay, cool. I also love the Holmes brothers. Shocker, I know. For anyone who listens to Book Hype, this is groundbreaking. I love them not so much in the original canon. I love what other authors have done with them outside of Doyle's stories. So I love seeing any new Holmes adaptation that has the brothers either as brothers, as brother and sister, as just the way that they play these two characters across any medium is just, I love seeing their take on that. Because the Holmes and Watson relationship, I feel like that's where people put so much focus on either changing or, you know, mixing things up. But it's really the Holmes sibling dynamic that I love in several adaptations, and that could make it or break it for me, which I think is why I don't like the Robert Downey Jr. adaptations, because there's just, I feel like there's nothing there for me with that, but that's okay. I still just accept that it exists in the world. And the final sibling pairings that I love, it's a big family and it reminds me the most of my family. So my family, there's five of us from two marriages. So it's the Foxman siblings from This Is Where I Leave You. And that's a book by Jonathan Troper. And it's a movie with Tina Fey and Jason Bateman, Adam Driver. And
love it.
Yeah.
I love that movie.
Those siblings, it hit me because they get along, but they're constantly fighting. And it's like some siblings pair off more than others. But they're all, when they're all together, it's so great just the way they deal with their mother. And so they all come together because their father has passed away and they're a Jewish family. So they have to sit Shiva. So they have to like disconnect from work and disconnect from all their problems that they left at home, but they follow them there. And, you know, they're all coming together and they're falling into old habits and they're seeing all the people from their childhood. And it's such a great book and movie. And I recommend checking it out, but it's just that family is anytime it's on TV, I watch it. And I wasn't even going to include them in this cause I kind of forgot about them, but then I have the book sitting like really close to me and I looked up and I'm like, oh my God, how can I forget about the Foxman siblings? So yeah, I love, love, love that whole dynamic. And that book just does a really great job of conveying what these siblings are like. And I think the movie adapted it so well from the pages of the book. So definitely check those out if you have a bigger family or want to know what a bigger family is like. It's so great. Oh, and Corey Stahl's in it too. Oh my God, I love Corey Stahl. He plays another one of the siblings. Oh, well, great. It's so great. I highly recommend it. Connie Britton's in it. Come on. You can't lose. You cannot lose with this movie. The cast is so good.
It is seriously great. I remember I stumbled across it on like Amazon and was like, holy cow, this cast is insane. I'm going to rent this and watch it. And I was like flabbergasted. I love that movie. Love it. I've watched it so many times. I can't even begin to tell you. You will not regret watching that movie, I promise.
I
think we watched it.
What? What movie is this?
This Is Where I Leave You. With like the Tina Fey and Jason Bateman and
I don't think so.
They have to sit Shiva.
No.
I swear I made you watch this. If we have it, you're watching it soon. Because it's amazing.
When I went to BEA, this was the book that was on the badges that year. And I went to the Tina Fey, she was talking with the author, Jonathan Trapper at BEA. And I went to the thing and you got a book and it was autographed. And that's where I found this book. Cause I was like, they were talking because the movie was coming out. So I went to the event, and they were showing clips from the movie. And but it was where I got the book. So I'm like, oh, I'm going to read this book. And I fell in love with the book. And then the movie came out shortly after, and it's so great. I highly recommend checking it out.
Yeah, I've definitely never seen this, Kristen.
I could have sworn we watched it. Okay, we will soon. Well, I will rectify this.
So you can come back having read Pride and Prejudice and watched This Is Where I Leave You.
Too much homework.
You will not regret. This Is Where I Leave You will not feel at all like homework.
Yeah,
trust me.
It's really good.
Fine.
It's fantastic. It's fan-freaking-tastic.
Yeah, and, you know, speaking of books that we never talk about that we actually love, I can't believe I've never really talked about this book before. We're going to move into a little segment called The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. And we're going to talk about The Good, which is books that we love but never really bring up in conversation, sort of like those forgotten loves. The Bad, which is the worst adaptation of a book that we've ever seen. And then The Ugly, in which we combed through one-star reviews of our favorite books to find the worst review that we could. And I had a great time doing that. I highly recommend it if you are ever bored and want to look up one-star reviews of your favorite books. All right, so let's kick it off with The Good, a book that we love but never really bring up in conversation. And let's start with Karen. What is your favorite book that you don't bring up often?
Well, I have mentioned this, I think, a grand total of one time on Book Hype, but I wanted to talk about Firebringer by David Clement Davies, because this book is something I read when I was younger, and I really don't talk about it a lot. I don't recommend it to a lot of people because it's kind of a strange book. It's very, very well written, but it's kind of dense and just different, and it's not one of my go-to books that I recommend, but it's told from the point of view of a deer. And the deer is the chosen one. He's got a special mark on his forehead. I think it's shaped like a maple leaf or something like that. And he's the one that is meant to kind of save all of them, his family and the whole, I don't know, herd. I think that's the right word. I want to say pack, but I don't think that's correct. And it's a very interesting book just because it is told from the point of view of a deer, but it obviously is an allegory and it relates to humanity and the way that we treat people and good and evil and owning up to your destiny and being brave and heroic in the face of danger and death and all of that. And it's just a very beautiful book. And he's written at least one other similar to this, and I believe that one is about a wolf, and I think there are others. I haven't read it, but I really want to because his writing is just so enchanting and so detailed, but not in a way that bogs you down, because I tend to have trouble with those kind of stories. That's why I don't read a lot of high fantasy, because it's just too much detail for me. I'd rather get through the story than, you know, really like sit in the setting. Because I'm kind of an action-oriented person rather than a character-oriented person. But this one's definitely worth the read.
That's really interesting. When you were like, it's told from the perspective of a deer, I was like, I didn't see that coming.
Neither did I. I was like, wait, what?
Firebringers.
Yeah. I was like, oh, like a phoenix or something? It's like, not a deer. It's a deer.
Yep. Deer, that's a new one.
That is interesting. Kristen, what about you?
Okay, so I had a lot of trouble with this because I talk about the ones I love all the time. So I like was combing through my Kindle last night, like, what don't I talk about? And I can't remember really giving my push for Crushed by Lauren Lane. We've talked about Lauren Lane a million times, but this book is the last book in one of her first series. It's the last book in the Redemption series, and it is so good. I fell in love with this story, and I don't really talk about it because it's not a stiletto book. Like, the stiletto series is the one she's known best for. It's not one of her newest, and it's not one of her flashiest, but Crushed is just, it's the story of these two sisters who are incredibly different. Like, they're basically as different as you can be. And the story is actually told from the younger sister's perspective, but you see her, like, existing in a world where her sister gets everything and she just is kind of pushed aside and people just basically pretend she doesn't exist. And the main, like, character, the main couple is Chloe, the younger sister, and Michael, who is related to the rest of the series. Like, the book is tied in through him. And it's just, it was a really different story. The way it was told, and I absolutely fell in love with the main character, with Chloe. She's amazing. And I don't talk about it very often because it's just not one of Lauren's more well-known books, but it's still one of my absolute favorites. And if you haven't read it, you really should. I also wanted to briefly mention Enchanted Ink by Shanna Swenson. When I first started, like, reading adult books as opposed to, like, all YA all the time, I wandered into, like, the, like, women's fiction section, and I discovered this book. It's so ridiculous. It's great. I used to describe it as Harry Potter for ladies, but it's not really that. It exists in, like, this world where magic also exists in the real world, very much like Harry Potter, but the main character in this book is important to the magical universe in that she has absolutely no magical ability whatsoever, and that is really rare. Like, most mortals, most normal humans, have just enough magic in them to be fooled by magic. They can't actually perform it themselves, but they can be fooled by it. So her having no magic ability at all makes her completely immune to any spell or trick that people may try. And so she becomes employed by this business, Enchanted Ink, as, like, a fact checker. Like, she sits in on meetings to make sure that people aren't, that magical people aren't using their abilities to manipulate others and that sort of stuff. Like, it's really fun. I haven't read the last two books in the series because they kind of snuck out into the world. I didn't realize she had added two more books to the series, and then poof, there they were. So I'm desperate to find some time to finish them, but it's a really fun, different kind of series. So if you're looking for something a little bit random, but a good time, it's Enchanted Ink. Give it a shot.
That sounds awesome. And, like, a weird, cool take on magical universes because, you know, you read so many of them and they all start to blend, but that sounds really different and cool.
Yeah. Yeah. That was my initial, like, I got into it because she had said something like, you know, if you were interested in Harry Potter, if you liked Harry Potter, give it a shot. Like, just try it. And I expected to be like, yeah, this is dumb. But it quickly was like, all right, I get it. I totally get it.
No, that's awesome. I'll definitely look into that as well. So I think I've talked about White Noise by Don DeLillo early on when I started coming on the podcast. And I think I've reread it once or twice when we've talked about what we've been reading. And I came across a flash drive a few months ago that had, I didn't know what was on it, but then I discovered it was all, like, my senior year English papers. And this is when I read White Noise, and it's so telling of my television tastes now, which it like the paper that I wrote, it just made me think, like, this book really just, like, changed the course of what I enjoy and how I enjoy it. And it's so dark and terrifying. And it's all about this professor who, his entire area of study is in about Hitler and Nazi Germany. And it happens during this this time where there's an attack. And so the first part of the book is all about just really getting inside of his head. And him and his wife are so terrified of death. Like, it is what drives every action that they make in the whole book. They're so terrified of death. And then what happens is there's a chemical spill, and they don't know if it's an attack or not, but they have to evacuate. And so the airborne toxic event is what it's called. And so as they're leaving, like, you're getting through this mentality, they're in the car, they're like listening to the radio constantly. And like, there's this like cloud coming and it's terrifying. And then the third part of it is about his wife getting access to like this drug that's supposed to eliminate fear, like eliminate the fear of death. And it's so end of the world, like no hope characters, and they're so depressed, and just it makes me think, I was like, because I was watching The Leftovers recently, and I'm like, this is exactly why I enjoyed this show, with zero hope and just everyone is just wallowing in their depression. I love it so much, and this book is definitely worth reading if you don't want to feel happiness for a while, because it's so good. I love it. I absolutely love Don DeLillo. I've read a bunch of his stuff following this book, but I read it first as a high school senior, and little did my teacher know that it was going to change everything that I read and enjoy from there on out. So yeah, I would definitely pick up White Noise if you like feeling a little bit of depression every now and then. That's horrible. It's a horrible thing to say, but I love it so much. But speaking of horrible things, let's talk about the worst adaptation that we've ever seen. Now, we talk about adaptations on here a lot, which isn't my favorite thing to do, but I'd like to talk about just the bad ones, because I do like complaining about adaptations. And I actually had a harder time thinking of this than the other two, which is odd, because I'm the first one to complain about any adaptation, and yet I had a hard time justifying what made a bad adaptation in my mind. Did you guys find any difficulty trying to do this as well?
Yes, because yes. I love terrible movies.
Well, like, the movie lover in me is very separate from the book lover in me, so I try my darndest to like appreciate the movie for what it is, even if it's not the perfect adaptation. So a lot of times, like, I can explain away a bad adaptation by like, okay, but they were making that choice because of the movie. There are still some that I cannot justify, but it was more difficult than I thought it would be to come up with a bad adaptation.
Gotcha. And Kristen, I want to start with you, just because I love this movie so much that I'm just interested to hear your take on it.
Okay. So I thought long and hard about all the adaptations I could use for this. And the one that kept coming to me is Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. And I debated going with Goblet of Fire, because there are some changes they made to that movie that is my absolute favorite Harry Potter book. But I could explain away the changes they made for, you know, one reason or another. So Half-Blood Prince comes in as my least favorite. And there are basically two reasons why the adaptation just makes me so angry. One is Ginny. Half-Blood Prince is like the moment where I finally realized that the one character they completely ruined was Ginny. In the book, so much happens between her and Harry, and the moment that I still can't get it out of my brain, like when she wins the Quidditch match and Harry doesn't know, and he walks into the common room and she runs across the room, like I could see that scene unfolding on film. Like when I read the book, I still can like picture the blocking of how that scene works, and they just didn't do it. Like they just left it out. And instead turn Ginny into this weird, you know, kind of creepy person who takes him up to the Room of Requirement and helps him lose the book. And I don't even know what happened up there. And then you have the final sequence where, you know, we have this really awesome scene as the Death Eaters are escaping Hogwarts, and you know, Snape and Harry kind of face off, but Snape refuses to engage. And you have this intense battle in which, I forget which Weasley brother, it's Bill, gets scarred. And, you know, it's an intense thing. And they cut the final sequence down to barely anything. And it just makes me so mad because their justification for that was that they didn't want to overshadow the Battle of Hogwarts, but the Battle of Hogwarts was still two movies away. Like they split the last movie, the last book into two movies. So they could have done a battle at Hogwarts and still not had it overshadow the Battle of Hogwarts. And it just, yeah, I have a lot of feelings, and Half-Blood Prince just, it irritates me to this day. It's my least watched of all the movies because of it, and it just makes me sad.
That's interesting. See, I never liked Ginny to begin with, so that whole thing didn't affect me at all. But I do agree with you in regards to the battle, because I did feel that it was very anticlimactic. Like when, you know, that whole thing plays out, Snape just walks away, mm-hmm. and then you go to, like, I get the emotional gut punch with Dumbledore, but that still could have happened.
Yeah.
And like you were saying, like, my least watched is 7 part 1, because I call it like, oh, that this is where we go camping. Like, that's literally all that happens in that movie is they go camping. And so it's my least watched for that particular reason, because I just found it like, so like, oh, right. Now all the action is in the second half. So I agree. We had like almost 2 years. I mean, granted, rewatching now, you don't have 2 years. You have like 2.5 hours, but you had 2 years standing between you and the big battle. And plus you had still another hour to get to that battle before it even happened. So.
Well, and as you were kind of saying, like, if they would have put a battle in there, imagine you would have forgotten about Dumbledore. Like this terrible thing happens. Harry has to run out to stop Snape and they have this battle, and then to come back to Dumbledore at the base of the tower, like it would be even more of an emotional gut punch, because you'd forget that you just saw Dumbledore die because you've been thrown into this action scene. Like, it could have had been so good, and they ruined it. Yeah. Okay. I'm done now.
Switching gears a little bit. Karen, I think we talked about this a little bit on our Dr. Seuss special, but please elaborate.
We did. Yeah. I was trying to avoid going for a Harry Potter movie, because I saw that Kristen was going to talk about Half-Blood Prince, and like, for the record, and I don't think this is shocking, but like Prisoner of Azkaban, not my favorite Harry Potter movie. And I think they absolutely destroyed my favorite book, which was Goblet of Fire. But I was looking for another movie that really, like, really made me angry. And that movie's The Cat in the Hat, the live action version. I hate that movie. I got it as a Christmas present from my mom, I'm pretty sure. And watched it once and have not watched it again. Now, you have to understand, like, that's kind of huge for me. I rewatch movies all the time. You guys know how much I love terrible movies. I actually went through, like, I kept finding lists of the worst book-to-movie adaptations to kind of jog my memory, because I couldn't think of anything other than Harry Potter right away. And they were like, Aragon. I was like, no, I really like that movie. And the Percy Jackson movies, no, I like those too. And there was, The Golden Compass was on there, and I love that movie. And there was all these different ones where I was like, this is not working out in my favor, because I just love terrible things, apparently. But The Cat in the Hat was on several lists. And I was like, you know what? That is one of the first movies that I ever truly hated, that I never, like, I decided I'm never going to watch this movie again, and actually considered, I think I still own it, to be honest, but actually considered, like, selling the DVD, because I hated it so much I didn't even want it next to my other movies. But I'm pretty sure I still have it in my cabinet, unfortunately. Maybe that's laziness or something, but yeah, it's just not. And the thing is, I never was super invested in The Cat in the Hat or Dr. Seuss. Like we talked in our previous episode, it wasn't something that I necessarily grew up on. So it's not like it should have affected me if I loved the story so much and they got it wrong. I just think it was a terrible movie, and not the good kind.
Yeah, it's a rough one. And I know I talked about this on our Dr. Seuss special. The only redeeming quality of that movie is the kitchen scene where they're baking cupcakes, because that's my favorite part of that whole movie. I have seen it more than once because if it's on, I will just leave it on if there's literally nothing else on. But I do agree, it was, they tried way too hard, and it wasn't, they couldn't recapture what they did with the Grinch, which I think is what they were trying to do, because the Grinch mm-hmm. was so good, and the Cat in the Hat was the same exact, like, you know, style and all that, but it wasn't, the magic wasn't there. It was gone.
Yeah, I think I've seen the Cat in the Hat once, and I do not remember it, like, at all. So I guess that goes to show.
I think I blacked it out from my memory. I hated it so much, really, because I remember, like, one part, and that was with, like, the fish balancing on top of the big pile of stuff, and that's it.
Oh, yeah, it's not a great footnote in the Dr. Seuss canon. Let's just leave it at that. But one of my least favorite adaptation is one that, Karen, you mentioned, and it's The Golden Compass. I, as a fan of Philip Pullman and his Dark Materials, and I've reread The Golden Compass several times when I was in grammar school, and I even reread it in high school, and I can't wait to reread them this summer with the anticipation of the new materials being added. The movie was just such a disappointment. It was the writing. I don't know if it was, I think it needed to be two movies, and it needed a much longer screen time if they wanted to do it. And it needed to be, or when the movie came out, I wouldn't argue that it needed to be a TV series. I would have said it needed to be two movies, but now that we're getting so many adaptations of TV series, this is one that had to be done on television with the right production company. And it is. It's going to the BBC. So I'm hopeful that the second go around with an adaptation will be better. But it just felt so lacking. I didn't care about Lyra at all. And she is so great in the books. You just didn't get the sense that they kept, like, trying to be like, she's special, remember? Like, the dust. Don't let children have the dust. And it would just felt so, like, I'm like, that's not the point. Point of the book is to convey how strong and resilient Lyra is. And the movie just, it didn't do that at all. And it was a letdown. It had a great cast, but it was just not well done. So I'm still not over it. I will never watch it again. I'm just going to pretend it didn't happen and go into the new material with a fresh face and get excited about the BBC series adaptation. And I wish I could expunge this from my memory.
But question.
Answer.
If we did a special about His Dark Materials and we read the books and we talked about how terrible the movie is and we talked about, you know, whatever new adaptation is coming out or whatever, would you rewatch the movie that way? Because I would be very interested. Like, I've read the series. I saw the movie first. And then because I liked the movie so much, I'm so sorry, I read the books. I know this is, like, between you and Natalie, like, they just want to kill me whenever I say this. Like, Karen, I love you, but I'm actually going to play you now.
Can you please read American Gods before you watch the series?
Okay, yes.
I know it's coming out so soon, but that is what I need you to read the book first.
I know. And
because really you're going to fall in love with the series. I can tell you that right now.
Yeah.
But I need you to read the book first.
But I really would like to reread the books because I never really connected with them. But now that I'm a little bit older and I'm kind of read a wider variety of books, I'd be very interested in kind of seeing how I feel about them now. And then I want to rewatch the movie to see if I hate it because I read the books after I watched the movie. So now in reverse, maybe I'd feel differently. And then of course, like, you know, whatever comes out next, I would be interested in tackling that too.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not opposed to trying to rewatch the movie.
I mean, we hate watched Avatar The Last Airbender for rewatchable. So we can do it with this.
Yeah. I made it through 15 minutes of that. I still haven't watched it. I watched 15 minutes and I said, I'm never going to get, it took me 3 days to get through 15 minutes of that movie. Cause I kept saying, maybe I'm just not in the right mindset. Maybe it'll, like, maybe I need to watch it in the morning. No, maybe I need to watch it before I go to bed. No, maybe I need to watch it while eating a donut. No, nothing saved it. And I still, to this day, I did the entire rewatchable special on the movie and I still didn't watch it.
Well, I have not seen The Golden Compass, nor have I read the books. So I have literally, like, at least I've avoided the movie, which apparently is a terrible adaptation. So that's the only credit I have to my name, is that at least I haven't seen the movie.
I would rewatch it having reread the books, because then I could just get angry about it all over again. I'm fine being angry about stuff. That's stuff. That's right up my alley. So, but speaking of people who are angry, there's a lot of people who hate our favorite books in the world, and they write reviews about them on Amazon or Goodreads or wherever we pulled these from. And I had a great time diving through the ugly part of our discussion, which is one-star reviews of our favorite books. And so let's kick it off with Karen.
Oh boy. All right. So I did not have as much fun with this one as I thought I was going to, because I looked up House of Hades by Rick Riordan, which is probably one of my favorite books of all time. Definitely my favorite Percy Jackson, Rick Riordan book. And this is the one where we see both like the Greek and Roman sides of this part of his universe. And I was like, okay, this is going to be great. Somebody's going to say something really ridiculous. Bad choice. This is also one of the books where one of the characters comes out as gay. And a lot of people gave it a 1-star rating because of that. So I was not having fun going through all of those comments about how you shouldn't show this to children and how dare he write about this. And he must have been pressured into this. Spoiler alert, he wasn't. He's just a decent human being. And I was getting very angry instead of laughing at people's comments. But there was one nugget in here, at least, that is so totally random. It was titled 1-star, and it reads, "Don't know how I got this. I read Amish books only." Okay.
All right. Definitely not Amish. This no. series, definitely no. not Amish.
Did you guys notice, I don't know if this is a pattern across all of Amazon or if this was just these readers aren't particularly bright sometimes, but a lot of the 1-star reviews, I'd say maybe a third of them, were actually meant to be 5-star reviews. They're like, "This book's so awesome." 1-star.
Oh, no, I didn't get any of that.
Really?
My book
there
that
were
I looked
a
up.
Lot of them for this book that did that.
Yeah, maybe, I don't know, maybe it's just the audience or something, but my book, mine was a bunch of, like, older, angry people being like, "My book club is very full, it's full of diverse readers, and none of us liked this." God, it was great. Kristen, I like yours so much. Just even the title, Unlikely Storyline.
Yeah. Okay. So I actually had a lot of trouble finding a 1-star review for this, which I am so excited about. I started off with Cora Carmack's Faking It because it's my favorite book ever. And on Amazon, it has 0 1-star reviews. 0. I'm so proud of the world. I am so proud of the world. Because, like, I kept trying to find, like, a really funny, like, just ridiculous 1-star review, and I was finding nothing. I even went on to Barnes & Noble and started checking theirs, and I was just coming up empty, which just makes me so proud. But I did find one review of Bet Me by Jennifer Crusie, which, if anyone knows, is, like, one of my ultimate faves, on Amazon. And as Brittany said, the title is Unlikely Storyline. And it reads as such. "I did a search, and the word donut turned up 74 times. Too much donut eating and references to the main character's round body. Not sexy or romantic, just ridiculous."
That is an incentive for me to read this book, that the word donut shows up 74 times.
Who doesn't want to read about donuts? Like, let's be real. Like, it just... If any of you have read this book, you know what it's about. It's great. I've talked about it a million times. It's one of those books that kind of got me into reading romance, and it will forever be a fave. I've read it a million times, and it still stands up. I just died. I was like, I love that they just, I don't know if they randomly decided to search for donut or if they read like the first two chapters and were like, this is a word that's going to show up a million times. If it does, I'm never reading this book. Like, I don't know, but good times, good times. Thank you, angry donut hater, for reviewing Bet Me.
So my adventure, I looked up The Secret History by Donna Tartt, and a lot of people were complaining that, oh, I read The Goldfinch first and this one wasn't as good, or, oh, nothing like The Goldfinch. And a bunch of them, like I was saying earlier, were like, oh, my book club read this and everyone hated it, and we're a group of diverse readers. And like, I'm like, okay, all right, calm down. It's not for everyone. I get that. And I knew that going into this, but I found one that just, this person took so much time and attention to getting this review to sound like really professional and great. And I loved it so much. And the title of it was, I felt like showering and brushing the foul taste from my teeth. So here it is. There should have been a bit of warning when I saw the author's dedication to Bret Easton Ellis, the author of American Psycho, one of the most despicable books of recent memory. This one is not quite as morally bankrupt as that, but neither does it have any redeeming value. It's such a tragedy when such skill with language is found in a book with no attempt at a moral stance. I had initially thought to read The Goldfinch, but was intrigued by the description of this one. Yet this is just another novel from a talented young group of authors without soul who elevate cynicism to an art form. Required reading for this group should be John Gardner's On Moral Fiction. By the end of the book, I felt like showering and brushing the foul taste from my teeth. Not one character with a shred of decency, and not one for whom decency is even a tentative goal. You can't call this story tragic because there is no fall from grace. The characters start off desolate and despicable and are more so by the end. I honestly don't know if I could tackle The Goldfinch now despite its accolades. One reviewer described this one as not quite as good as The Goldfinch. That's a little like saying smallpox isn't quite as bad as Ebola. Having survived one, I'm not about to risk the other.
Wow.
I love this person so much. Because I could never put into such great words how much I hate something. I loved it. I loved reading these, especially the people who are just like, too long. It is a long book. It's almost 600 pages. But they were like, got through one chapter, couldn't handle it. Unbelievable setting. One person actually argued that they couldn't figure out when this book was set. And they went through like very specific examples being like, this could point to the fact that it's in the late 80s, but also this could be in the 90s. But then this shows that it's in the 70s. And I'm like, who cares? It's supposed to be like timeless, I guess. Oh, it was so great. I had a great time reading about people hating my favorite book because I know it's a slog to get through because, again, I guess this English teacher changed my life more than I'm willing to give her credit for, but I read this book in that class that I read White Noise in, and yeah, none of the class liked it except for me, and then the tables turned in that class when everyone liked Life of Pi and I hated it. So it was a great class. Such a great class. Anyway, we spent a lot more time on that than I was thinking. I was like, this will take up maybe 15 minutes of our discussion, this good, bad, and ugly section. But we do have some book news to get to. And I wanted to kick it off with a story that I came across that I didn't know was happening. Cara Delevingne, model, actress, YA star, has... You know, she was in a John Green novel, so of course she's going to write a John Green novel of her own. And I'm actually really intrigued by the plot of the novel that she is going to be releasing in October, and it's currently available for pre-order, but it's called Mirror, Mirror, and then Trapeze. I'm not sure if that's the full title or not, but it's about a group of friends who are 16, they're in high school, they're, you know, classic YA, struggling through high school, they don't know what they want to be, they're coming of age. But then one of their squad, there's four of them, dies under very tragic circumstances, and she says, like, leaves behind one word, which is sorry. And I just finished 13 Reasons Why on Netflix, and I thought it was a great adaptation of the book. And I think this is, like, right up my alley, having just come off of that. But I'm curious about how good of a writer she is. I think she's really passionate about the projects that she, you know, goes into. And so I'm interested to see what kind of writer she is and just what can come out of it, because it can go either way with actors and, you know, having a career shift. Like, it worked out great for Chris Colfer. I think that all of his books are fantastic. So I'm interested to see how this book turns out, and I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to be dark, and, you know, as I've previously discussed, I'm all for that. So
I think it's always very interesting when actors decide to go in this direction, because if you think about it, there are a lot of actors turned musicians or musicians turned actors, and those two things sort of go hand in hand, because it's all about performance. And if you have a voice, like, a lot of actors tend to have, you know, at least a decent voice anyway, and they're trained in that sort of art. So it's never that big of a deal, but writing is a very different medium, and you kind of lock yourself away for months on end, and you have to put things into words rather than acting them out visually. And I feel like it takes a very different kind of skill set. And like you said, Chris Colfer immediately jumps to mind. And for him, I feel like that switch was a no-brainer. He is brilliant both on screen and off. And I don't know how she's going to be, but I'm also intrigued, because it could be really interesting and different, and she could have a really cool and unique perspective, and I'm definitely looking forward to seeing what people say about it.
Yeah, and I think that there's a, like, John Darnielle just came to mind, because he is a writer, but now, and but he, the lyrics that he writes for the Mountain Goats are very story orientated, you know. And like Watsky also, his music is very, it reflects well in switching between writing and performing in that musical sense. Whereas acting, I think that she can come at it from a character perspective and understanding the characters that she's playing and the types of roles that she can get her head around. Like, you know, I think actors can come at writing that way. It's just the skill of transferring that onto a page where I feel like there's a little bit of, there might be a disconnect.
Yeah.
But I am looking forward to see how it turns out, because I think that the premise is really good. I think that she will have a strong grasp on the characters, just judging by her career of what she's played. And I'm looking forward to checking it out and seeing what becomes of that. Also happening in the book world, there is a new Star Wars book coming out, and it's 40 stories celebrating 40 years of Star Wars, and it's called From a Certain Point of View. This is really interesting because it's a bunch of authors coming in and taking characters and telling backstories and or events told from different perspectives, and there it's going to be a big anthology. So I think that this is a great idea for any franchise. I personally am not invested at all in the Star Wars universe. I've never seen any of Star Wars in my life, but I think that this is just such a cool concept. Like, there's authors like Chuck Wendig, who's also writing, you know, Star Wars spinoff series. But you have other authors like Meg Cabot and Daniel Jose Older and Ray Carson. All these authors are coming together to tell a story from a different perspective. It's almost like writing fan fiction almost, and just being able to dive into a part of a world that you really like and telling a story from a point of view that you think is untold, which I think is a really cool idea. I was like, okay, well, when is the Star Trek version of this coming out? Because I'd be really into reading that. or even writing something like that. I think that if you're given such a narrow scope of which to write in, especially for such a giant franchise, if you could just really hone in on one thing and tell a story that you want to tell, I think it's going to really play well for Star Wars fans, because these people are coming in and they're only writing about something that they care so deeply about in such a large universe. What do you guys think of something like this for any like fandoms that you can think of that you would enjoy reading, or even this one if you do like Star Wars?
This does sound interesting. I think the idea of expanding that universe, especially with this, where it's so big already, and I guess in this case it would be taking a slice of it and putting the light on that rather than expanding it because it's so large. But I think this is a really interesting idea, and if there's a favorite character or a favorite moment and you kind of get an up-close view, fans are really going to respond to that. And if it's coming from one of their favorite authors to begin with, it's sort of win-win in my book.
Yeah, the whole concept of this sounds like a ton of fun. Like, you know, you read series like Harry Potter, or you watch movies like Star Wars, and there's so many characters, and you know that they each have these incredibly interesting, crazy lives. Like, you wish you had time to get to them all. So I think this is a great way to give more perspective and to add to the fandom. Like, doesn't want more Star Wars? Like, I'm not a huge fan, but it's kind of, you know, it's had its resurgence with the last couple movies, and there's a whole new generation who's kind of discovering this. So it's really nice to see them take on like this book series that's all gonna, you know, like just knowing that there's a whole bunch of YA authors who are ready to bring it to a new generation is kind of really cool.
Yeah. Plus it's not as canon breaking as some of the other stuff. So like with Chuck Wendig, for example, he's like introducing a whole new like kind of realm and addition to the Star Wars world. Whereas, you know, this is like the stakes aren't as high. It's 40 short stories, and I think it will be fun to read, as opposed to like, oh, I have to accept this now, and this is something that's changing the way I feel about a certain part of the Star Wars universe. So I think it's really cool, and I hope fans enjoy it.
Yeah, if anyone ever wants to read about what was going on in the Hufflepuff common room during Harry Potter, I would read that. 40 short stories.
40 short stories from the common rooms.
That would be
10 stories each.
That would be so cool.
I was actually like, I don't think I would want this from Harry Potter. I don't know why. It just feels kind of sacred to me. And I don't know. Maybe it's because we get inundated by all of the other stuff and kind of over it. But 40 short stories, I could definitely do that.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. Especially from like just random students, like not people we know and love, like not, you don't need to get Neville's story, or, you know, like I'd love Neville's story, but like not people we know and love and know very well, but just random students, and like see their perspective on either the Harry Potter like era or some other random time in Hogwarts history. Like, it would just be fun.
You guys should check out the comic. I'll send a link for Kristen for you to put in the show notes, but it's such a hilarious comic. It's called Background Slytherin, and
I have seen things about Background Slytherin.
It's always like events are happening, and like this is like this little girl who's just in Slytherin, and you know, she like interacts with people, and like it's always during like big events and like dark times, and she's just like, so is anybody studying for this potions exam? And it's they're all very funny, and it's like very minimal drawing, and it's the way they draw Snape is hilarious. It's wonderful. I highly recommend checking out Background Slytherin. It's so good. But speaking of expanding some universes, George Takei is going to be retelling some of his own personal story before Star Trek, before he really dove into the world of activism. And it's going to be an autobiographical graphic novel, which I think is really interesting. There's a unique way to tell his story, and it's going to focus on a bit of his early childhood. So he was 5 years old when Pearl Harbor was attacked and his family was forced into a Japanese American internment camp. And he's going to be telling that story because part of his activism includes spreading awareness of what happened during that time in American history. It's not really talked about that much. There's a lot of movies, you know, oh, Pearl Harbor this, Pearl Harbor that, but it doesn't really focus on what happened in the United States during that time. And he's going to tell his family's story from a first-person perspective. He did this a little bit with the Broadway musical Allegiance that was based on his family's story while they were in a Japanese internment camp. But this will be much more accessible to a larger audience. Like, you don't have to travel to Broadway to see what happened. And I like the fact that it's going to be a graphic novel because sometimes autobiographies, you know, I just can't really get into them. I'd probably rather listen to it or, you know, especially if the author is reading it. But a graphic novel is really, really cool approach to telling this story. And because it's illustrated, it could go to a much larger audience, I think. So what do you think about him choosing to opt for a graphic novel and tell this story? He's also going to focus on his later life, but to really put the focus on this.
I think that's amazing. I love graphic novels. I think that it's always great to read a book, obviously, but when you can have artwork to accompany that, it just gives you a different perspective on that. And you can really imagine, obviously, what it looked like and what it felt like. And it's a very similar medium, obviously, because it's still a book and you're still telling a story, but it uses a very creative way to get that picture across. And I just think he's so cool and so interesting. And his story and his life is so full of all of these different events and things that happened to him. And he is a great spokesperson for human rights in general, but I really appreciate his gay rights activism and all of that. And just to see it come alive in a graphic novel, I think could be really interesting. And maybe, you know, somebody who doesn't usually read an autobiography will decide to pick this up because it is a graphic novel.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, this sounds incredible, not just because it's George Takei, who I, you know, who is amazing in every way, shape, and form, but I don't know if I've ever heard of an autobiographic novel, like, as a graphic novel. Like, that sounds intense and amazing, and I hope that this does really well, and that other people, like, that have stories to tell can get on board with this, because I feel like that would be a really interesting way to tell your own story, is to, like, not just, like, tell the story, but to have the comic or, you know, visual representation of it, too. Like, that sounds incredible. So, yeah, I'm definitely on board.
The closest thing I can think of, and it's not necessarily autobiographical, but biographical, is Mouse by Art Spiegelman.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And that's obviously about the Holocaust and all of that, but that's a graphic novel that is biographical.
Also, and Karen, we saw this, Fun Home is is the story of Alison Bechdel's childhood and her relationship with her father in a graphic novel form, and it's fantastic.
Yeah, I think about that play every so often. It was very good.
Yeah, it was. That was very good. I'm glad we got to see it when you were in town. I'm going to toss it over to you, Karen, for two more little book news bits that we have.
Yeah, so a couple of interesting stories have come across lately, and this is about what else other than adaptations. We do have to get better, I think, about talking about book news that isn't adaptations, but they're just everywhere these days, so it's kind of hard to avoid them. But these are two kind of different stories, so I'm really excited to talk about them. The first is about Geek Girl Rising, Inside the Sisterhood, Shaking Up Tech by Heather Cabot and Samantha Wallravens. And I really want to read the synopsis for this because it's hard to kind of summarize it in my own words, but it says, meet the women who aren't asking permission from Silicon Valley to chase their dreams. They're going for it, building cutting-edge tech startups, investing in each other's ventures, crushing male hacker stereotypes, and rallying the next generation of women in tech. With a nod to tech trailblazers like Sheryl Sandberg and Marissa Mayer, Geek Girl Rising introduces readers to the fearless female founders, technologists, and innovators fighting at a grassroots level for an ownership stake in the revolution that's changing the way we live, work, and connect. Readers will meet Debbie Sterling, inventor of Goldilocks, the first engineering toy for girls, which topples the notion that only boys can build. Peek inside YouTube sensation Michelle Phan's Ipsy Studios, where she is grooming the next generation of digital video stars while leading her own mega e-commerce beauty business. And tour the headquarters of The Muse, the hottest career site for millennials, and meet its intrepid CEO, Catherine Minshew, who stared down sexism while raising millions of dollars to fund the company she co-founded. These women are the rebels, proving that a female point of view matters in the age of technology and can rock big returns if you have a big idea and a passion to build it. Whew, sorry, that was a mouthful, but I think that this is fascinating because we don't get a lot of stories about this, and obviously, like, this is true to life. These are real people and real stories, and the way that women can make their mark in a very, very male-dominated industry. And Variety reported that this is going to be turned into a scripted television series for ABC. Kelly Ripa and her husband, Mark Consuelos, are going to develop it, and they will also executive produce. This book isn't even out yet. It's getting published on May 23rd. And I just love that it's already being picked up for an adaptation. And I think that this is very different to a lot of the adaptations that we've gotten so far, because this is obviously, you know, based on real life. And not that there aren't adaptations that are coming out about books like this, but a lot of them tend to be fiction. And I could see this kind of being a really cool feminist show, and I hope ABC and Kelly Ripa and her husband take the time to make it very powerful. And I think it's interesting too that Kelly Ripa is the one picking this up. She's kind of made her mark in a very male-dominated industry, and I feel like she could really connect to something like this. So I'm hoping that, I haven't read it. I am hoping to get my hands on it though. But I feel like this is something she could really go to bat for.
Yeah, it sounds great. And I'm already liking it, even just from the description and just imagining what a TV series could do with this, more than I am looking forward to, like, Girl Boss, which is coming to Netflix. I think that that adaptation looks horrible.
Oh my, I was actually going to bring that up. I think it looks amazing.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm not into it. I've watched the trailer a couple times thinking, like, oh, my opinion will change, because I was like, oh, they're going to make this into, like, a series. I'll care a little bit more about it. I read Girl Boss and it was fine. I read it a long time ago, but yeah, I don't know. I'm not feeling it. And I'm a little, the only thing I'm nervous about is ABC. ABC is not great at launching new shows, I feel like, recently, unless they have Shonda attached to them. So I just am preemptively nervous, not because I don't think that they could do a good job with it, just because ABC doesn't give time to shows that don't instantly get Shondaland ratings. That's my only concern. I think that everything else sounds fantastic. I'm just nervous about it being at ABC. But I do think the Kelly Ripa connection in keeping it within the ABC family might help it out a little bit.
I was going to say, yeah, that might help, just because, like, ABC seems to be best when they are, like, promoting their own, like, when it's a Shonda show and it's, you know, Shonda show number 3 and everyone already loves Shonda. So of course they can, you know, get people to watch this. People love Kelly Ripa, and knowing that she's behind this and is producing it and helping develop it, I think that may be a really, really instrumental in getting this series, like, off its feet. I really do think it could do well. And yeah, the whole idea, I would not have thought of adapting something like this, but I'm really glad that they're doing it because it sounds really cool.
And you have a little bit of more adaptation news.
Yes. So the second story is about Labyrinth Lost by Zoraida Cordova. And this book is being optioned at Paramount. And the reason why this is an interesting story is because We actually found this book at BEA last year, and Danielle, who's been on the show before, was like really excited about this because this was put out by Source Books, which is a local Chicago publishing company, and she had a couple of friends who worked there, and she's like, oh, I really want to grab this book for my friends. You guys should check it out too. And we're like, oh yeah, it's got a really cool cover. It's kind of a Day of the Dead. This girl's wearing like a big flower in her hair, and she's got a skull painted on her face. And the story is about this woman, or this, I think it's like a YA novel, so she's probably like a teenager, but she's a Latina witch, and she rejects her destiny. She doesn't want to be a witch. She tries to cast a spell that gets rid of her powers, and her entire family disappears in the process, and then she has to figure out a way to obviously get them back. And it's obviously a diverse book if there's a Latina main character, and if it's about kind of the Day of the Dead sort of thing in that culture, it's something that immediately piques my interest. And Paramount snatched up the rights to this book, and they're going to adapt it into a feature film. And it's still really, really early on in the development. So like, there's no information, no producers, no director, no actors or anything, but I'm hoping that they can do this right. And I'm hoping that it kind of leads into what I'm seeing as being a little bit of a new era where people aren't afraid to delve into other cultures and make their adaptations more diverse. I mean, this one, the source material is already there, so let's hope that they don't try to whitewash it. I don't think they would, because the whole book is basically based around her being who she is, but I think it could be really cool.
Hollywood doesn't seem to care about that.
Yeah. I mean, that is true, but I mean, if you look at some of the things that have been coming out recently, like the problems with Iron Fist, the problems with Doctor Strange, the problems with Mulan in the initial script there, people are really starting to get angry that whitewashing is going on. So I'm hoping that the industry is paying attention, and something like this, where the source material already provides this really in-depth, beautiful look at this kind of thing, that they'll respond to that, and then that'll get the audience on board as well.
Yeah, I think it could be a really great adaptation. I have not read it, but I do know a little bit about the book itself, so that would be something I'd be interested in checking out and maybe bringing back to discuss with what we think they could do with this, because like you were saying, it's an interesting time in Hollywood, so they could really get it right with an adaptation of Labyrinth Lost. So come on, Hollywood, get your act together.
Do us proud.
All right, so that wraps up another episode of Book Hype. And what do we have coming down the pipeline? We're going to have a special guest next week. Our friend Caitlin is going to come on, and we're going to talk about some movies and TV tie-in novels, which will be fun and exciting and interesting because, you know, one of my biggest things is don't read the comics when it comes to TV series. And she's going to probably try to convince me that I should read the comics because it'll change my world, especially in relation to Avatar. Then we are going to finally get our Jane Austen episode recorded and up for you guys to read, hopefully by the end of April, beginning of May. And if you have any suggestions on stuff you want us to talk about, I know we've been trying to do more theme episodes and talk about things that we're either not as familiar with, but are happy to explore and learn more about, or awaken a part of ourselves that we didn't know we actually did like, which is like poetry. So yeah, if anything comes to mind that you want us to talk about that is not adaptation based, please let us know and we will put it in the pipeline. But until we return, I am Brittany.
I'm Karen.
And I'm Kristen.
Bye guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay, the backup is recording. Is anyone there?
Oh, okay. And silence. I was thinking the same thing. I'm like, wait. Something didn't just go crazy wrong.
As soon as I hit record, I was like, oh no, did I kill it?
Oh no, I was just waiting.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's right, I'm hosting. Okay, that's fine.
I was wondering if you forgot again.
I did. It only took 3 seconds for me to forget that I was hosting this thing. Okay, here we go.